So this panel is the first one we're going to have is called The Trip So Far. It's history and stories of some of our communities. The speakers are myself, Bob Jesse. Is he here? Yeah? You want to come up? Bob Jesse's from Rhythm Society, and also Rob Rail, if he's here. Is Rob here yet? Yeah, from Koinonia. And Ethan, who just stepped out for a brief second. He'll be back in about, 2.5 minutes. He's back. This is Ethan Miller, friends and family. Sure. What we'll do is maybe just each spend our 5 or 10 minutes talking about where we're from and sort of the communities and stories we grew up in. I'll pass to Ethan to start because I'm going to go run out and get a couple notes from my car. But Ethan's from Friends and Family. I've known him for at least almost 10 years probably. And he's actually a big influence in my coming into the electronic dance music scene. So take it away, Ethan.
Thanks, Scott. This thing on. How's everybody doing out there? So today I'm going to talk about transpersonal. No, just kidding. I guess the subject at hand is the trip so far, and in that context, it was asked of me to kind of relate the history of friends and family. I assume with the point to lead up to kind of where we've gotten so far. And I feel like I've told this story to almost all of you before, but it was reminded to me last night that the origin myths, or actual stories, not myths, actually gain value and find new meaning and repeated meaning and new interpretations in their retelling. So I'll try and cover where we've been and see what comes out along the way. So friends and family, as a collective of people that throws events and sought to build community, started a long time ago, I think 93 or 94, and the fact that I can't remember the actual date bothers me at times. I go back and look at flyers and try and piece it together. and the initial impetus for Friends and Family was a bunch of people hanging out on SF Raves, which Brian Behlendorf right here started, and talking about parties and talking about going to parties and analyzing parties and doing some Monday morning kind of quarterbacking and realizing that there was something really important and really special going on at these events, that there was a whole new kind of space of people interacting with each other in very positive ways going on, and there was a lot of power there. And yet, there was a lot of discussion about the things that weren't right with parties and that were compromising parties, and some of these included, you know, kind of abusive practices on the parts of promoters and turning off the sinks and turning up the heat and things like that. So in the midst of there being a lot of excitement about parties being thrown, there was also the sense that they could be thrown better and that there was in some ways some compromising of the essential magic of raving that was going on. So at the same time, we were meeting all these people that, you know, were hanging out on SF Raves that had lots of talents and lots of energy and whatnot and wanted to kind of do something better. So, and there were a variety of efforts and parties coming out of that. One such effort was something that myself and Bryce, who is not here, Bryce Ryan, started to do a Sunday afternoon party at the Third Wave Dance Studio at 24th and Mission, which some of you may have gone to parties at, called Open House on Sunday afternoons. And this was supposed to be, you know, a $2 or $3 thing to just cover costs and, you know, have a Sunday afternoon way to hang out in a nice space in the Mission and dance together. And it was very much intended on our part for the SF Rave, what we perceive to be the SF Rave's community. And this was like, okay, we've all talked about doing it better, doing it different, so here we are, we're going to try and do it different and do it better and do something that's super low cost and happen. And so we threw two of those, and one of them, the first one was very well attended and we had a good time, and the second one, which actually featured, from our standpoint, the Northern California debut of Jill Rice, who drove all the way up from L.A. to a completely empty house. There was nobody there, and we got pissed. We were like, hey, you know, all this talk, and we're trying to do something for you, and you didn't come. And so both Bryce and I, you know, kind of spazzed at everybody on SF Raves and said, what the fuck, you guys suck. This is bullshit. This was from our hearts. This was for you. Where were you? And got a very surprising reaction. A lot of people said, don't impose your fucking community on me. This is a yellow pages for me. This is where I find out about parties. You can't place that expectation on me. You can't yell at me after the fact for not understanding your expectations, et cetera, et cetera. And so that was some, you know, and there was a lot of, you know, intensity and emotion around that. So that was some very interesting information to get back, because we felt like we were on this divine mission to, you know, to make it all good. So we took that information and we said, okay, well, so we still have this vision of how we want to do parties differently and better. And so what do we do with this information? So what we decided was that you can't, you know, impose on people to come and support your vision, that you have to invite people to help create that vision with you. And if they are feeling connected and feeling ownership and feeling like it's their creation, that they're going to tell their friends, and that's how you get people to a party. So our first experiment in trying to apply this new way of thinking at that time was to throw another party. and somewhere along the way I came up with the idea of calling that party Friends as a Family, with the idea being, and I'll touch on this again later, that family doesn't represent, in that context, relatives of yours. It represents the idea that you are friends, and beyond that, you're also family by working together on something. So we decided that we would get as many people as actively involved as being kind of creative producers of this event as possible, and that those people would in turn invite their friends. And so the venue for this first event was a house in Noe Valley called the Blue Cube. And there was a garage that was nice and spacious, and a kitchen. And so we threw this party in the middle of Noe Valley, like a 29th and Church or something. It was ridiculous. And we had my rather large sound system in this garage, and we had turntables in the kitchen upstairs. And there were some didge players from Australia that played on the stairs outside. And I think ultimately, you know, all in all, there was like, you know, 35 or 40 people that had some kind of creative, you know, interaction with this. There were people that were making smoothies. There was people that were playing live music. There were DJs. There was, you know, Laura Legasta brought a little red pin laser, I remember. and it was just amazing how in such a small little house party, in effect, there were so many people creatively involved. You know, Philip, I remember bringing his dad and recording the whole thing. And they all invited, you know, 3 or 4 or 5 people, and lo and behold, yet 150-person party, which was double the attendance we ever got at open house. And so in the middle of Noe Valley, on a thick, foggy night, we just thumped it all night long, you know, with an apartment building next door and a residence there, and it went, and nobody fucked with us, and it was really an amazing party. So that was the essential kind of genesis of Friends and Family and the Friends and Family model, which I could go into some more detail about. How am I doing on time? 5-10 minutes. So we learned in that exercise that idea that if you involve lots of people in the creative genesis and creation of a party, and they invite their friends, that you can really actually get people to come to an event and have a good time. So we also had some other kind of more specific goals in mind in terms of how we want to do parties differently. And one of the things that I had an issue with in the parties I was seeing was how much social kind of stratification I saw falling out of knowing how much work it actually took to throw a party, to show up early and to sweep the floors and to, you know, clean the space and make the space good and to hang the banners and to just, you know, kind of make the space feel special. And a lot of people just doing that work completely for free, you know, and like being the first there, hanging lights, being the last to leave, taking the lights down. You know, the same time DJs were rolling in and getting paid $1,200, $1,500, whatever it was. I remember hearing stories of how much DJs got paid back then that just shocked me. And so that whole kind of aspect of money kind of creating levels of significance within an organization of people that were throwing parties specifically kind of bothered me, and I think bothered some of the other founders as well. So one of our goals in Friends and Family was to be not for profit and not non-profit, but anti-profit. And that it was really important that nobody get paid for anything, and that, you know, the generation of revenue not at all be a goal. Certainly cover your expenses, which hopefully you can keep to zero. And towards that end, towards keeping, you know, expenses to zero, We also kind of had a culture of donating just everything, not just the labor, but equipment as well. And it's just amazing to think of, you know, how much incredible stuff we came up with. I remember me and John Carroll, like, patching our sound systems together, and Dave bringing lights, and everybody kind of coming up with stuff. And we would make, you know, really amazing, beautiful parties with, you know, gear that was completely donated. And as FNF got bigger over the years, that kept getting bigger, and I think really reached its probably pinnacle at the Halloween. We threw a party at this, what we call the truck stop, which is a truck yard in Oakland. I think that was 95, 96 maybe, Halloween. Anyway, that was like this gigantic production. It was 1,000 people underground, completely, you know, unpermitted party in Oakland, with all these truck containers everywhere. And, you know, the first time Ed Colmar worked with us on lighting, and, you know, it's this huge main room and big towers with dancers on stage, you know, little, what do you call those, little towers of scaffolding going up by their side, and just fog everywhere and lights, and two more sound systems outside. And there were these truck containers. I remember Alex Windsor took fluorescent string into these huge spider webs inside these truck containers. But and so this massive production value, it was this huge party with these great, amazing production values, and all the gear and all the labor completely donated. So that those were also kind of some of the ideas, I think, that kind of feel what we were about. And also trying to demonstrate that that kind of production value and that kind of expression of energy and creativity didn't have to have a $20 or $30 price tag. And that one of the reasons that we were so into kind of donating it all was that, you know, that party, I think, was a $5 party. And so just kind of trying to prove the point that you still had to get some money to kind of cover your costs, but that you really could do amazing stuff for super low cost. So that's kind of some of the ideas. There were other ideas that were very important, I think, to the organization in terms of how we organized ourselves, not just the points we wanted to make, but a large part of, I think, what FNF means to people and what's made successful over the years was in trying to really have a consensus-based organization. So a kind of a very traditional part of throwing FNF parties is planning meeting or meetings prior to, where we really try and put all the issues of importance to that particular event on the table, and not leave a given point with anybody being unhappy about the resolution of that point. And that's been I think a great thing to do over the years, but gets harder and harder as FNF as an organization got bigger and bigger. But I think we've always kind of tried to fulfill on that promise and done pretty good. I think in trying to kind of land us 2 minutes, that works out well, where we are today. And one of the things that represents a challenge to myself and I think to the other people in FNF right now is that as a group, we've gotten so large and we have all these kind of traditions and processes around how we make decisions that trying to achieve consensus among a very large and passionate and opinionated group is a lot harder than you might imagine. And it almost kind of feels lumbering and bureaucratic at times. So I think the challenge, you know, facing FNF and facing successful collectives that want to employ those kind of processes is how actually you stay nimble and you actually are able to produce and achieve events when you have a very large group and a diversity of opinions about how to do things and what to do. And I hope to touch on some of those points again a little later.
Thank you, Ethan. We'll just go down the line and go to Rob next. Rob's from Koinonia.
Yeah, hi, I'm Rob. And I feel a little weird about doing this because I haven't been in this scene all that long. I got involved in 96, late 96, early 97. My first, I've been doing electronic music of some sort since like the 70s, but my first involvement in this scene came when I went to Burning Man 96. That was the hell year. And there was this band floating around there called Beyond Race that was doing some weird electronic thing with like electronic tribal something or other. I don't know if any of y'all remember them. And I never even made it out to the rave camp that year. Burning Man that year, the rave camp was a mile away from the main camp. I never even got there. I was just so engrossed in what was going on in the main camp and kind of overwhelmed by it all. But I heard this music and I thought, that's really interesting music, and I think it has something to do with something called raves. And when I get back to San Francisco, I'm going to go check some of those out. And so I got up on SF Raves when I got back, and just by luck or chance, randomness, the first thing that I encountered was this party called Mantra that was happening in San Francisco, like 9th and Howard, at this place that's now a bar called SF Asia, but at the time was a shut down, empty building. And I went there and was just blown away by the music. It was psychedelic trance music, and a lot of the people who are, you know, just by coincidence, a lot of the people who are now you know, a big part of my life were at that particular party. And at that party, I was approached by this really strange-looking 19-year-old boy with hair down to here, skinny as, like, I actually thought he was a woman. I thought this person was like, I thought, that's a really odd-looking woman, but kind of attractive. And he handed me this little tiny little piece of paper, like this big, you know, that said Koinonia on it and a little phone number. And I said, well, this odd-looking but somewhat attractive woman just gave me her phone number. Boy, this is a funny name, Koinonia. So you know, okay, well, I guess I should call. And So anyway, so I called the number and got some kind of recording and left a message. And anyway, later on, we hooked up over email, and they found out that, you know, because of my involvement in various kinds of music, I had some sound equipment. So, like, they immediately latched on to that and was like, yeah, come to our party. Bring your gear. So I went to some things with these people. And they were down in Santa Cruz, and it was just this kind of Santa Cruz hippie thing. And I really liked the flavor. I really liked the feeling of it. And then Lauren, you know, told me I should, you know, to really see what this was about, I should go over to this place called the CCC, which was this kind of international. It was basically, you know, I didn't know this at the time, but basically it was a place where people who like to travel overseas, where the dollar is worth a lot of money, can come to San Francisco, you know, and live in a warehouse, you know, with like 10 people to a room, pay like $100 rent, and, you know, work at Starbucks or whatever, make $10 an hour, and save their money, and then take it over to Asia where it's like worth a ton, you know, and have their fun there. But in the meantime, they can, like, you know, they can, like, mark off their time and save a little money and, you know, live cheap here so that they can go travel. And anyway, but this warehouse was also kind of an art scene, and it was, you know, also about doing the kind of parties that were done in places like Goa, India, and Koh Phangan, and Thailand, here in San Francisco. And, you know, I don't know if any of you have ever been in the CCC. I'm sure some of you have, but if you ever, you know, walked in there, it was just like mind-blowing. It was, there wasn't a lot of lasers. It wasn't a lot of like high-tech stuff. It was just all fluoro art and black lights, but it was like three deep. It was like, you know, it was like every conceivable bit of space on the wall would be covered with, you know, not one banner, but three layers of banners, kind of, you know, you just couldn't, it was just really mind-blowing. And there's all this, like, kind of, all this Hindu symbology, Buddhist symbology tied up with it, and I thought it was like some kind of, you know, religious cult. And these people, you know, we're all into kind of psychedelics, you know, more hardcore psychedelics rather than, I would say, you know, club things. And that kind of all, you know, fed into that sort of messianic flavor also. And I just, you know, I felt like there was something there, but I couldn't put my finger on exactly what it was. So I, you know, decided, I just felt like I had to explore it some more. Anyway, but the one thing about the CCC people, and, you know, with all props to them, they were totally cool, but they were kind of like, if you weren't in Goa in 1992, you're not really happening. And, you know, and I was just showing up. So I mean, they really were a traveler scene, and if you were not a traveler, it was not, you weren't like on the same wavelength with these people. It was you know, a traveler's art scene. And traveler's art scenes are great, but they're not really about forming a community in one place. They're about traveling. And this group Koinonia kind of came about with, like, a bunch of us people who, like, kind of liked the thing that the CCC was doing. We liked the flavor of it, but we wanted to do it in a more welcoming and open way, and we wanted to form a community around it rather than have it be kind of a way station. And so basically we just started throwing parties with whatever we had, and much like friends and family, it kind of started small and got bigger and bigger and bigger and peaked out around maybe 99, 2000, somewhere in there. And now it's kind of declined. But here's, you know, kind of what I've taken from it. First of all, things have to keep changing to stay alive. Second of all, universal rule, you get out of something what you put into it. I have some of the best friends I have in the world are people I met through Koinonia, and we still get together. You know, even if the parties we throw are not as big as they used to be, the gatherings we have where it's just like the 30 or 40 of us who threw those parties, who really put the work in, are better than they've ever been, and we're closer than we've ever been. And it's, you know, that's where the really, really the magic comes in. And you know, our tastes are changing. We're doing different things now. I think that, you know, maybe in another couple of years, some mutated offshoot of this will become something huge. You never know. And the other thing that I found really valuable about this was that I felt like at a certain point I got to feeling like, you know, I kept like feeling like there was something there that I wasn't quite putting my finger on. And as I started to really get to know the people I was working with, I found that a lot of them, you know, as I do also, a lot of them had, like, you know, they had problems. They had personal issues. They had things to deal with in life. And I was a little older than most of these people, and they would, like, sometimes, you know, I'd ask me for advice or look up to me in some way. And I felt like if people were going to, you know, be looking, you know, at me in that way, then I needed to have, like, a really solid core. I really needed to, like, have something to offer these people so that, you know, I wouldn't be just like, you know, all of us kind of scratching our heads, say, we know there's something there, but, you know, what is it? So I began really, really devoting myself to a spiritual practice that's gotten, like, more and more intense over the last 3-4 years, and I'm continuing to devote myself to that. I'm not going to get into what that is. I'm not, you know, but I felt like I had to develop myself personally in a serious spiritual way in order to not just be kind of like another one of those people saying, yeah, there's something there, but I'm not sure what. You know? So I have some ideas, but, you know, if you're interested in that, talk to me later. Anyway, and that's all.
Cool. Thank you very much. This is Bob Jesse from Rhythm Society.
Good morning. It's great to be among friends. And family and more. Oops. Is that all right? Okay. I'd like to start by giving a little disclaimer, and that is that within the Rhythm Society, we have been and I think for really good reasons, resistant to having one person represent the group, to have one point of view, seed people with a notion of what the group is, both because everybody involved has a different view of it and a different set of priorities and maybe a slightly different set of values, and also because to talk about something in some people's minds is to limit it. It's to, you know, that's what it is now, that's all it will ever be, or to otherwise constrain it. So just please keep that in mind. I thought before making some notes here if I should try to be very clinical and detached about it or go ahead and tell you how it looks through my eyes. And, I'll do a mix of both. Ethan said at the beginning of his talk that it was going to be a transpersonal something or other, and no, it isn't really. Well, I'm sorry. I have to do this for about a minute. There is some transpersonal stuff here. I'm just going to read a short little list. And the invitation to you is to see if any of these things describe experiences that you've had, very possibly, I think very likely on the dance floor, maybe elsewhere. Okay? Unitive consciousness, the sense that all is one. One basic, essential, nuclear characteristic. Beyond space and beyond time. Feelings of joy, peace, happiness, blessedness. A feeling that what is apprehended as holy, sacred, or divine, or from a non-theistic perspective, a deep sense of reverence. Paradoxicality. Things that seem ordinarily not to be reconcilable are obviously all true. And very difficult to talk about, ineffable. Especially difficult to talk about to people who have not had an experience like that. Show of hands, for whom is that familiar? Okay. This is a book written about 50 years ago. These are pretty well accepted now descriptions of what is sometimes called primary religious experience. And one of the things that excites me about being here, that excites me about my own community, is that such a high fraction of the people involved know what this is about. And my personal opinion, Rhythm Society doesn't necessarily say this, is that that's the core. So, some RS history. Has its origins back in the early 1990s. SF Raves, thank you, Brian, was a big connecting factor for a lot of us. And I was struck, as both of you spoke this morning, about how much commonality there is in these stories. It may sound a little repetitious, but some of these things are probably worth repeating. This happened in SF Raves, and it happened in communities that branched out of that. The very first raves in San Francisco that I ever knew about, mid-1990, were very underground events. You know, maybe somebody charged a few dollars, but this was not a set of commercial promoters, and for the most part, not necessarily people paying the rent out of this kind of activity. And when it broke into SF Weekly and into the press, there came to be more and more of these events, and they started to take on a commercial character. People had significant rents to pay on buildings, facilities, equipment to be rented, DJs to be paid, lots of money. And it resulted in a pretty competitive atmosphere. A lot of people thought, wow, this doesn't feel quite the same way as the word-of-mouth underground parties of a couple years ago. The very beginning of 1992, I was struck with one of these experiences, out of which came a passion for seeing if it could be done better. And within about a half a year's time, the first couple of events happened that carried the name Rhythm Society. They were co-produced by somebody who had done a lot of commercial events. And somewhat like the first part of Ethan's story, I would describe those as, let's call them learning experiences or blind alleys, okay? You know, what didn't work? Well, printing a whole bunch of colorful flyers and leaving them in coffee shops and record shops and stuff doesn't necessarily give you any idea of who's going to show up or how many people are going to show up or what they're going to show up for. for these first couple of events, we had some extra things to offer. It was intended to break out of the mold a little bit and offer more than just ecstatic dance. And some people got that. But it is not the case that community formed out of it. I found that pretty disappointing and in some ways a little embarrassing. You know, you have a big dream and you try to do it and it doesn't work. And and the Rhythm Society pretty much went dormant. You know, a lot of the same people who had participated in those early events saw each other, but became dormant until through a chance meeting, I met a person who was then organist and musician at the Episcopal Church of St. John the Evangelist in the Mission District. And what formed out of that quick and fast friendship was the ability to try this experiment again in an overtly sacred setting. How many people have been to St. John's Church? It's a lot of hands, okay? So you know what it looks like. Those blind alleys were not without value because it caused those of us who got together in what you might call the second incarnation of this group decided to do things differently. And here's just a list of them. Possibly inspired by the physical facility of the church itself and all of the archetypal implications of that, and partly formed by understanding this to be primary religious experience. Some of what happened is we adopted some of the things that churches have long done. This is going to be never for profit. We're going to ask for donations. The churchy language for that would be free will offerings. Not charge a ticket price if we can possibly avoid it. In fact, we're not going to call them tickets. We're going to call them invitations. All volunteer. Most services, most equipment donated. Try to get as many people involved as possible. There's a lot of space here, physically and in every other way, for involvement. A big decision for us early on was the invitation policy, you might say. Are we going to print invites and put them in record shops, or distribute them from helicopters, or put it out on every email list we can think of? And the decision, which I think it has really formed the Rhythm Society in a lot of ways, for better and for worse, I think overall for better, but it has its downsides as well, was invitations will be given to close personal friends of the organizers, what then were called the planners. The email list was sjplanners@rhythm.org. From the outside, this can look exclusive, closed, elitist. From the inside, what it results in is an event where most everybody knows somebody or is separated by one degree. And a lot of us think that that has made a real difference in how the celebrations feel. Another point of nomenclature, and again, maybe this derives from having these events in an obviously sacred space, using sacred architecture. We mostly don't call them parties. Informally, a lot of us do. But on email and printed on the invitations, these are ANDCs, all-night dance celebrations or dances, okay? Which, to my thinking, brings us a little bit more in alignment with religion rightly understood. And I'm going out on a limb there, because a lot of people in the Rhythm Society, well, there's a part of me too, would bristle at the word religion, so just know that that's a dicey thing to be saying. What else did we decide to do pretty early on? Some notion of container. Instead of having an event which is a party where people kind of come when they like and check it out and see if it's sufficiently cool, if the music is to their taste, and maybe kind of split if it isn't, we're going to ask people to come before an opening ceremony. In fact, pretty much from the start, we said we're going to close the gate before the opening ceremony. And within a couple of events, we had stabilized a policy of when the gate's closed, if you come after that, you know, please don't come. Come to the next one instead. And we ask people, although we've never required it, to please plan to stay the entire night, to stay through the closing ceremony in the morning. So you have a full circle of participation. Not everybody does, but a lot of people do, and the invitation still stands that way. We had a lot of conversation about what to do in these ceremonies, and a lot of conversation about what to do with the fact that we're in a church that's got a big cross up there, and that speaks to one religion and probably actually to the experience of a minority of people in the Rhythm Society who would identify as Christian or be much immersed in a Christian background. So that's an ongoing conversation still. To what degree do we use language or symbols of a particular tradition or a particular culture? The answer that's always in flux seems to be, well, let's just bring it all on and try to offer it in a way that is least imposing, most inviting, that looks for the common ground, that allows people to connect with what works for them. What else can I tell you? Some more commonality. Very early on, right from the start of St. John's Divine Rhythm Society, as we took that name, St. John's Church, the decision-making was participatory. No person is in charge, per se, with the possible exception, a little footnote here, for what happens during an event if the cops show up. You know, somebody's got to be able to make quick decisions if needed. I would use the word consensus, except that that means different things to different people. Let's just say we look for group mind, for a solid center. And for a while, that worked for us. The group was fairly small, the planners, 15, 20, growing to maybe 30 people. And we hit a hitch at one point where there was conflict within the group. It persisted for more than a day, a week, a month, a couple of months. A lot of people said, this isn't fun anymore. We have one celebration where some things went wrong at the gate, partly as a consequence of this. And at the next planners meeting, a lot of people said, you know, I can't keep doing this. It started out being fun. I don't want to do it anymore. That resulted in about a half a year of a small group called the steering committee meeting to figure out what that problem was and how to try to work around it. And the group reformed itself with a slightly different decision-making structure. It is still largely a process of looking for group mind, of having contexts for conversations by email, in-person meetings, to work issues through, to listen to each other as respectfully as we can. But there's now something called the Rhythm Society Council. It started out as 6 people, now it's 8 people. The beginning we elected them. Now there's a self-selection process to eliminate usually the necessity for elections. And I can say more about that, but let's just say this is a modified form of unity decision-making. In my own mind, I think quite a lot about the Quakers, otherwise known as the Religious Society of Friends, which has given us our use of the word friends. We talk about Rhythm Society friends, and the email list is the friends list. What else can I say? We have developed what, to use churchy language again, might be called a liturgical calendar, and it looks like this. We have, or we try to have, all-night dance celebrations on a quarterly basis, on the third Friday of months which contain a solstice or an equinox, which is usually pretty close to the solstice or equinox. In December, we have usually moved that to December 31st, but this past year we did not, and actually stuck with the third Friday of December. The 8 months that do not have a solstice or an equinox, we often, not always, have something called a Friday night gathering, which is an event usually with some kind of a structured activity, maybe a workshop on contact improv or mask making or storytelling, followed by some light music and some dancing, and we knock off at midnight or 1 o'clock. Every month, 9 days after the third Friday, there is a community meeting, and everybody's invited to get together. The facilitation of those meetings rotates. Basically, all of the leadership positions in the Rhythm Society rotate. And this is a forum to augment email, to talk about whatever issues are on deck for us. We do something called Supper Club. Once a month, there's a mechanism for people to metaphorically put their names in a hat and get matched up in groups of 3 or 4 or 5, often people you don't know, often randomly matching up newer people in the community with older people in the community to go have a potluck dinner or go out to a restaurant together. We've added over the years to the liturgical calendar a weekend retreat once a year, usually around Easter time. For a couple years now, we have done a weekend event at Willits. And a lot of us, I certainly do, actually think of this in terms of a liturgical calendar. What's up? You know, what's next? And one of the things that I like about it is that friends who don't live nearby with a, it's a pretty good gamble, has been a pretty good gamble, to invite friends from far away to buy advance fare airplane tickets to come to celebrations. Because you can usually count on their happening on a particular schedule. And again, speaking very personally, because I'm going to use this word that bristles for some people, I like my religion to be bigger than me. It doesn't happen at my convenience. There are these regular events that happen whether I'm ready for them or not, whether it's right after September 11th or whether it's a more comfortable period of time we get together as a community. What else can I tell you? We're doing on time. 1 minute. Okay. We have had a very interesting relationship with St. John's Church. For a long time, it was left pretty ambiguous as to whether this is an outreach project of the church. I don't think they ever had an idea that they were going to get a lot of pledging Christians out of the enterprise, but a lot of people at the church were very happy to see a segment of the population otherwise unchurched, to use the churchy word, brought into a church, you know, under whatever purpose, for something that is arguably the very core of spirituality, of religion. Over the years, there have developed some crossover between the two communities, what we now call dual members. Some people from the church got involved in the Rhythm Society, and a few people from the Rhythm Society got involved in the church. Which reminds me one other thing in our liturgical calendar. The Rhythm Society for about three and a half years now has had a choir of its own that does quarterly choir services, singing music, and with a little Quaker time in the middle for people to just sit in silence or share stories with each other. About 6 months ago, we hit a hitch with the church. In the remaining negative 15 seconds, there isn't time to tell you much about how it came about, but we have very recently separated from St. John's Church in a process that's been very painful for a lot of people. Has pulled the Rhythm Society, mostly against its will, into the press, and very likely now or within a few days into the Associated Press even, like in kind of big time. And that means we are at a crossroads. And that's both pretty scary for a lot of us and very, very exciting for a lot of us, too. Thanks.
Okay, I guess it's my turn. For most of you probably know me, I think. A lot of you do. I'm just going to talk a little bit about myself real quick and then talk about Cloud Factory. I'm one of the seven people who started Cloud Factory. I grew up in Salinas, which is a suburban area 2 hours south of here. My first parties were very, very large commercial parties, a rave called Sharon, if any of you remember that party, or those parties, per se. So I was introduced sort of not into the underground community and by good luck found the Full Moon Raves that were happening that Wicked was throwing every month. And for those of people who know me closely, you know I'm kind of entrepreneurial. So we had this idea to do this little booth where we would sell toys and water and then give away candy for free, sort of to break even. This was sort of my little scheme. And it was very funny because we had never been to a Full Moon Rave, so we didn't quite understand the way it worked. So we had this little booth and we're selling water and sort of got all these sort of snooty, like, so what are you doing over here? Like, you shouldn't be selling anything, and sort of found some good people and found some people who were a little bit sort of too snooty. But anyway, after that, it was sort of clear. We decided that the next one we would just give everything away for free and ask for donations, which ended up being a lot of fun. Of course, I spent a lot of money. But anyway, it sort of got me into the whole thing and opened up our vision into the fact that things didn't have to sort of have this money scheme around them, and you could have a lot of fun just doing something because you wanted to. And so from there, I went to college and sort of met some people online through V-Rave, which was a service on Hyperion. Met Susie and Brian and Bryce. Ended up making a lot of friends that I didn't know, and then went to this fabulous party called Liquid Air that Ethan and Bryce were throwing. And there were 13 people there. There was Ethan and Susie and Brian and Laura. 12 people were dancing, and one person was DJing. So it was quite a bit of fun. And after that, then subsequently went to friends and family, which sort of inspired us to do our own thing down in Monterey. We ended up getting a bunch of people from Salinas and a bunch of people from Santa Cruz and sort of communicating via email and deciding to do an event. We met every week for 7 weeks planning. We were way over planned for an outdoor party that was $3. But the best thing about it was we had planned all this time, and then we were finding ourselves with a week to go, and we had everything together, so we just decided to throw a party that day. So we went ahead and did our first party totally unplanned the week before we planned our first party, and then we did a party the next night too. So we ended up having quite a bit of fun. Sig, who's here, was the first girl ever at a Cloud Factory party, the only girl at the first Cloud Factory party. So from there, we sort of grew. I was in college, a lot of us were, so we did a lot of parties during the summer. We did mostly outdoor events that were free or $3 or something cheap so we could pay for the gas and the generator. Bryce, who's good friends with Ethan, used to drive down and bring a generator to us, and we sort of got help a lot of the same ways everyone else did, just wherever we could find an amplifier or a speaker or cable somewhere. So we very early on were very email-centric and very diversely spread out because I was in Oregon, Bryce was in San Francisco, a lot of people were in Santa Cruz and Monterey, so we started out in a very distributed group, which was good for our growth, I think, because it kept us really diverse and introduced lots of new elements into the group all the time. Some of the things we wanted to do were to throw a party for ourselves so that we could DJ at it. We weren't interested in becoming superstar DJs, but precisely for that reason, we needed to throw on parties because we couldn't get into doing bigger parties because we didn't want to make demo tapes and go and do the whole schmooze and try and do it. It was much easier just to find a sound system and do it ourselves. We were very sort of anti the DJ ego thing, so we also made a conscious decision very early on not to have a group of resident DJs, as they were called. Interesting that we were influenced by Wicked, who had a very core set, but we wanted to stay away from that and always have different DJs, so you never really knew what you were getting when you came to the party other than that it was going to be good. You weren't coming to see someone, you were coming to be with the group of people and to be at that event versus like coming to see a certain D person. And we've always sort of had a very somewhat decentralized organization. We don't really have a way to make decisions, which is sort of one of the reasons I'm interested in discussions like this, because as we've gotten older, it's sort of become more apparent that maybe we want to make decisions, and sort of talking to people about how that happens and how that works in a group of 150 people, and how to maintain diversity without alienating people because you're deciding something, be it political or even just in your group, is sort of interesting topic for discussion on how you can keep that going and keep the community growing and together. Let's see what else I have. Some of you may or may not know, in the last year or two, we filed for our nonprofit status with the state of California. So we sort of have these two groups now. We have the sort of the Cloud Factory underground list and then the Cloud Factory nonprofit group. It's been an interesting process, and we're still sort of, this is one of our first big events. The last one was we brought the fashion show under the nonprofit umbrella. So we have the fashion show, and we're planning on doing more of these. And so the goal of the nonprofit is essentially to start to break out from just doing straight up dance parties and start to explore different things we want to do, different avenues of letting people have creative outlets and helping people also who want to know how to throw events, whether it be an art show or a dance party or whatever, a fashion show. Because we have within our community in the past 10 years, Friends and Family, Cloud Factory, Koinonia, all these groups, we have developed this amazing infrastructure of talented folks like Radiant Atmospheres and Ethan and Pascal who do sound and Jacob who does sound. So we have a lot of resources for any sort of creative event, even a lot of close connections to Burning Man. So it's some people just need to realize that they only have to ask and there'll be help for them to do whatever they want to do. They don't have to do sound or learn how to do sound. So that's sort of one of the tasks of the nonprofit group, is to help people understand that they can do whatever they need to, and the help is there for them. So there's other questions about community that I'm hoping people will talk about today here, are how do groups evolve and how do groups keep changing without changing the underlying character of them. Some of these guys talked about some of the problems and issues they're facing. It'd be interesting to see what other people think about those issues and problems in their own communities, and essentially get it out in the open and start talking about it is the best way to figure out how people are going to go forward. I think that's about it. Let's see, we have about 15 minutes till the next session, so we can probably take a few questions if people want to ask any of us questions, maybe 4 or 5 questions. JD? And Cloud Factory has a mailing list that's about 150 people.
Rhythm Society identifies 2 levels of participation. There are people who have elected membership. That number is about 120 now. There's a larger circle of people who've chosen to hang out with the group, participate in email conversations, come to community meetings, but have not elected themselves, nominated themselves into that smaller group. I think the total is a little shy of 300.
I would say Clinania consists of a core group of about 30 people, and there's a constant flow. People are always leaving, and other people are coming in.
I think FNF has about 100 or so people on its planners mailing list. For any given planners meeting, the amount of people that actually kind of show up and are interested in participating seems to be between 40 and 60. Thank God it's not bigger. But the actual number of people that will actually end up, working on one of our campouts, for instance, will, be in the hundreds, actually. And the size of FNF campouts these days is, about 800 or 900 people, if you're lucky, if you can keep it down to that.
Maybe not this year.
Except for this year.
Yeah. Any other folks, questions or comments, or anyone else want to talk for 5 minutes about what they're doing?
It happens I live with a 3-year-old who's not mine. Some good friends of mine who I've met through the rave community rent the upstairs of my house, and they're a couple with a 3-year-old child. And I think when he gets to be a teenager, he's going to probably become a Republican or something, I mean, I don't think you can expect that he's going to necessarily embrace the same things that we embrace. But as far as like him being in the community now, he comes to the campouts. He's constantly exposed to the music. He likes to dance. He likes to shake it, he doesn't come to the clubs much. Usually they get a babysitter for the indoor events, and they bring him to the outdoor events in the summer.
Yeah. I'd like to counter that perspective. a lot of you that have been to FNF campouts have probably seen my 3 kids bouncing around them, and they're totally into it. I'm actually amazed at the extent to which both my older kids really identify with FNF, with Friends and Family. They very much have the sense that it's a tribe. They say, "Oh, when are we going to see our FNF friends again?" Things like that. Both my son and his friend Zeke, who is a complete terror, who you can now see juggling and unicycling at Chillitz. they're both begging for DJ spots now. I mean, first it was just I had to handle my son, and now his friend is jocking me for gigs. My kids are 11, 8, and 3.
Wait till they're 13, man.
But, Zeke is 12. I don't have a concrete answer for how that next generation is going to propel this culture forward, but I have absolutely no doubt that it's going to happen in some way, shape, or form. It's actually been really great to see at the campouts this summer. There's just so many more kids around, and they're all getting bigger, and their personalities are developing, and they're doing things like juggling and cracking jokes and spoofing you and stuff. So, I'm tremendously excited to see how that goes. Just anecdotally, it's been really interesting to see my son has been into DJing and likes breaks and whatnot. But there must just be some surge of testosterone around the age of 11 that like forces you to listen to punk rock or something. I did it, but they're just like totally into punk rock right now. So there is probably going to be, you know, raves again now where you're going to be hearing punk rock. It'll be cyclical. It'll spin back through the retro decades.
The Rhythm Society is about to experience a baby boom. But it hasn't much yet. Sam Shirley, however, is about 5 years ahead of the trend, and I wonder if he'd want to say something about that.
I want to talk a little bit. I have two girls, I have six. And my wife and I bring them this morning. They go to the Rhythm Society. They have to and they sing all night long. They love it. When they hear that kind of music, they go, church music.
Okay, we're gonna take a 10-minute break between the next two sessions. So, let's see. I don't know if we want to. Did anyone have one short? Did you have a short question or? So thanks to all the speakers on this panel. In 10 minutes. In 10 minutes, we'll meet back here, and we're going to have the community dynamics of dynamic communities.